You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help. We're joined today by Ann Todd, who's been a contributing author and consultant for the National Geographic Society. She's also given presentations in national parks about OSS operations and works as a historian for the National Museum of the Marine Corps. She's the author of OSS Operation Blackmail, One Woman's Covert War Against the Imperial Japanese Army. Welcome, Ann. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
I'm very glad to be here.
So a book like this it always interests me because not only is it a well-researched book on OSS history, you've obviously hit some archives in doing this research, but you really have someone who you've been able to tap into as, you know, a huge advantage over the rest of us who, you know, I read this and I want to have a conversation with the subject of your book, and you actually had that opportunity. So can you talk a little bit about the idea for this book and how you were able to look at the subject of this and talk to her in person, which is just fascinating.
Well, I was casting about for a dissertation topic, and I realized the OSS archives had been declassified. I'd heard it and just, you know, kind of filed that away. And then I ran across Betty McIntosh's nonfiction book, Women in the OSS, which is a great read. And I decided this has got to be it. First of all, I always wanted to be a spy, so, you know. So I came up to Washington and got into the archives, and a very kind archivist gave me her phone number and said, "Why don't you call her?" So I cold called her.
Doesn't get any better than that, right?
And she answered. I went to interview her and immediately knew this woman is amazing. She's lived five lives. And so I asked her if I could write a book about her.
Well, you clearly supplemented that with some significant work in the archives.
This is a dissertation.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to do all your primary research.
Well, I spent a lot of time in those archives out at College Park, and it's not a lot of fun.
They're
someone I will pay a lot of money to go in there and find a way to categorize those a little bit better than they are, just the finding aids and everything else. It's really tough work. I mean, they declassified everything, but it's all just kind of there.
Yeah, apparently there was an archivist there, John Taylor, who was really making sense of the OSS archives and getting the finding aids in order, but he died, and it's very difficult. Otherwise, I think there'd be a lot more dissertations about this topic.
Right. I mean, it's kind of the black hole of understanding U.S. history, intelligence history. I mean, there's tons that CIA has done. I mean, now it's digitized, and it used to be you had to schlep down there to get on CREST, but now you can sit in your bedroom and access CREST without even leaving. OSS is just not there, and there's just millions and millions and millions of documents. It's just very difficult to find the ones that matter. So we can be missing a whole chunk of American intelligence history and not know it because people can't find the information in the archives.
Well, and when you go after something, you can't just get one box.
Right.
You better get boxes on either side and just plan on being there all day. And sure enough, a treasure will pop up, you know, three boxes down that I never would have seen. So, yeah, it's not for the faint of heart.
Well, what's interesting is that a lot of Betty McIntosh's life was in CIA. And it's relatively recent. I guess she retired in the 80s mm-hmm. from CIA. So there's, you know, at some point could be a volume two to this book when finally all the CIA documents get released. I think you probably have first dibs on writing that second volume.
The thing is, Betty, like a lot of OSS veterans, she took her secrecy agreement very seriously. And even things that she probably could have talked about, she wouldn't, you know. And so the thing about my book is it's not just the primary research and the documents. It's that I got to spend hundreds of hours with her. I think that's the kind of book I like to write.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it certainly shows, and you probably had to do some zhuzhing to this from the dissertation into the book, but it doesn't read, for those out there that are worried that this reads like a dissertation, it certainly doesn't.
I had a very indulgent committee, really. One of my members was H.W. Brands, and, you know, he writes for everyone, Robert Abzug, my advisor. So that made a big difference, because not every committee will let you do that.
Yeah, usually there's a lot of work that has to be done to a dissertation mm-hmm. to turn into a book that any normal human being will mm-hmm. want to read. So what I found very interesting about this, and for those out there that might have OSS fatigue to read another book about someone jumping in behind enemy lines or blowing up a bridge, this is an entirely different ballgame in this book. Really, the central point of this is propaganda. And it's not just the kind of same old propaganda of posters and other things that you see from World War II. It's black propaganda. It's kind of like the real devious stuff. Talk a little bit about those differences between white and gray and black propaganda, and why that OSS was able to kind of carve out their niche in World War II doing this really dastardly black propaganda.
Well, first of all, I'll tell you, no one else wanted it. No one else wanted to do it. America had such a bad taste in the mouth after World War I and all of that propaganda. Donovan was all about it, you know, because he, like Winston Churchill, he wanted to set Europe ablaze with, you know, the same sort of thing the Nazis had been doing. And the thing about black propaganda is not that it's so dark and devious, which it is, but it goes to point of origin. So you pretend something was printed in Japan when it wasn't. It's printed in India. Or a radio broadcast, same thing. It's point of origin, you know. You are pretending to be someplace and someone you're not.
Right, so it's not like Radio Free Europe or the Office of War Information that's putting out, this is coming from the United States government.
Right.
We want to convince you we're better, but you know exactly who's saying this.
Mm-hmm.
Black propaganda actually looks like it's coming from either themselves or from something
usually.
Completely different.
Yeah. And the Office of War Information, that's interesting. You know, there was a split because they believed that the best, most effective propaganda is based on truth. So did MacArthur. The black propagandists believed you build your scheme around a grain of truth, you know.
And it was really black propaganda that ends up saving the OSS, who was lined up for disbandment until they were able to kind of carve out this niche for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that something, you talk about Donovan believed in this, but is it kind of a chicken-egg argument about him embracing this because it was a way to save the agency?
Oh, no. No, no. Donovan was publishing things, you know, in open source newspapers about the value of propaganda and arguing that, you know, there was fifth column activities and that we needed to fight on that same level. So, no, he was all about it. It just happened that the split came and he was ready.
Yeah.
And he just said, oh, yeah, I'm here, I'll do that.
One thing interesting about black propaganda is that the target isn't a soldier, but it's the man behind the soldier, right? It's really getting at human emotions and mm-hmm. kind of, you can't do it well unless you're empathetic, like you put yourself in the shoes of these people. And anyone who's done any basic research or even just gone to school and learned about the Second World War, the Japanese were not seen as susceptible to this, kind of the machine of the Japanese soldier of being unthinking and unfeeling, and then tied into the fact that most Americans completely misunderstood the Japanese culture. And, you know, if you look at before the war, there's all this stuff about their pilots were bad because they had inner ear problems and they were too stupid to do anything like Pearl Harbor and all the
small.
Right, too small. They were all automatons. All they cared about was the emperor. They refused to quit. All the you can just very quickly Google some of the caricatures of the Japanese leading up to the war. But the people that are doing this work could not subscribe to that. They had to try to get into the soul of the Japanese person, not the soldier, but the person themselves.
Well, Betty loved to say, if you want to deceive someone, you have to love them. So, you know. I will say, this may sound sexist, but the women were deadly when it came to this stuff because they were empathetic. You know, they did see the son or the husband within the Japanese soldier.
They could see a homesick boy instead of a sort of person to kill. You have to think of that. It's probably extra difficult for these people because it's not like taking territory or winning a battle or bombing a city or anything else where there are concrete, tangible results to your operation. You could do black propaganda for the entire war and have no idea if it's working or not.
Yeah, there's no clear victory or defeat on the battlefield of the mind. And it is not for people who need instant gratification or any gratification. It's the process is opaque on both ends. You don't know really exactly where your target is or exactly who it is, and you never sometimes even know if they received the message.
Right, because there's no way to check if they're actually reading this stuff. You just have to send it off in the ether and hope it gets back to someone.
I mean, I found some traces in the strategic bombing surveys of Japan that were, you know, completed right after the bombs were dropped, after the war. And there was indication that some of the propaganda did get through to the home islands and, you know, made some difference. But it was real hard to find concrete evidence of that. But if they come walking out of the jungle with an inducement to surrender in their fist, that's it.
I mean, yeah, you see that with the strategic bombing survey of Germany also, where they talk about Marlene Dietrich and how much that damn, you know, music made them want to give in more than even the bombing did. It's almost to a degree like guerrilla warfare or counterinsurgency, where it's not about winning. You're not going to win the war with black propaganda. It's just about not losing. It's about trying to find ways to maintain your operation until there is tangible results somewhere else and hope that you had a hand in producing those tangible results in the end.
A lot of these people, Donovan deliberately recruited artists and authors and journalists and kind of what would be considered squishy people. And a lot of them looked at this work and thought, this will save lives on both sides. You know, yes, the goal is to win the war, but if it's done right, it can save lives on both sides.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about your heroine, Betty McIntosh. She has an extraordinary upbringing, something that you talked about her being empathetic. I mean, a lot of it is also learning the Japanese language, Japanese culture, being immersed at that level that, you know, many of us just don't have the opportunity to do. And that certainly gave her insight into, it sounds condescending, the Japanese mind that others did not have.
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, you know, let me just tell you a little background. Betty's mother, before the First World War, was a reporter, independently living, a professional woman in Washington, D.C. I mean, think about the date there.
Right.
You know, so right away, you've got an incredible parent. Her father was a sports editor. So she had the whole kind of encouragement that anything's possible. They called her indefatigable in the theater because she couldn't be stopped. You know, she wouldn't have said her upbringing was all that extraordinary, but, you know, she got a journalism degree. She went home, was a cub reporter when the war started. So, but yes, she and her husband lived with a Japanese couple while their house is being built and totally immerse themselves in your traditional Japanese home with the soji screens and the whole bit, and developed quite a bit of fluency, as much as an American can, really.
Well, that level of fluency is important, too, because it's not just about book learning Japanese. Mm-hmm. It's about being able to use vernacular and use slang and use things mm-hmm. later on that would be... You can see, I mean, if you to talk about modern day, where you look at Twitter feeds and you can tell that's not an American.
Because oh, no kidding. They don't use
syntax,
conjunctions,
all that stuff. You're like, that's someone who learned English in a book. Mm-hmm. That's not someone who's lived this. And the same kind of thing, instead of a Twitter post, they're using postcards. The same kind of thing is important because this black propaganda would fall flat on its face if it was this very rigid, you know, language that you would learn in school, especially if it's a letter back from a soldier to his mom or to his wife or someone else.
Well, and she knew just enough to know what she didn't know. Yeah. She knew that when you learn Japanese in Hawaii, you're basically learning what they call farmer Japanese, what somebody out in the fields might speak, which can work well for a common soldier. And so her project, Blackmail, Operation Blackmail, she realized that the kanji writing that she was reading was very simple, you know, messages, not a high level of education. So she knew she could work with that, you know. But when she got ready to falsify an official surrender order, you know, from the high command, she knew she had to go find a POW that would help her. So again, you know, she knew what she didn't know.
Right. Do you think that was somewhat conditioned by, we kind of skipped ahead a little, let's go back, about her limitations that were placed upon her as a reporter covering the Pacific War and kind of having to get around some of those limitations? And really what brought her to the OSS in the first place is a desire to do more than she mm-hmm. actually was, and being able to be creative in finding ways to exist and succeed as a woman at the time when they had almost no possible ways of helping to win the war effort. I mean, even as a top-line reporter, they said, you can cover the Pacific, but you can't actually go to the areas mm-hmm. where you can actually cover the war. You've got to do these kind of feature puff pieces on, yeah. you know, supplies moving around and women doing things.
Well, and a lot of that they didn't even allow to get out yeah. because the Army, you know, just didn't want anything getting off the islands. But Betty was like water, you know. She would get around anything. And she had a low tolerance for frustration. She's a pattern in her life. If the frustration starts to build, you can feel it. You can almost see it. And boom, she either hops over an obstacle, goes around it, sweet talks somebody, bribes somebody, whatever it took.
So she was prime at the time, as she was frustrated for being a reporter, to be recruited by OSS. And they did come to her and seek her out and recruit yeah. her for experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was something that, it's almost like you imagine, you know, in the movies where it kind of gets tapped on the shoulder by a guy she'd never met before, a shady-looking guy saying, hey, come join this organization.
That's exactly how it happened. She was at an agricultural conference, and she described it like that, you know, he just appeared out of the mist, kind of. And but I've heard a lot of other people describe that same thing, so I think it was kind of a mode of operation for these recruiters, you know.
Well, that had to be interesting for her, but she certainly admits that she was not someone you would consider the stereotypical mm-hmm. secret agent, right? She's not going to mm-hmm. be climbing on the monkey bars and going jumping out of planes and parachutes. This mm-hmm. is a relatively slight woman. But they had the perfect job for her, along with a bunch of interesting cast of characters. I mean, they're going to be names when you read this book that you're going to recognize. Maybe some of them don't have the same last names as you know later on, because they haven't gotten married yet, but people like Paul Child and later on Julia Child and people like Jane Foster, who is an extraordinary historical figure, are thrown together of this kind of motley crew of people you would not expect to be working for the OSS, but they have what I would think is an extraordinary impact on the war.
Someone said, you know, there's a lot of walk-ons in this book. And Motley Crue is exactly what it was. I mean, in many ways, I think you could describe all of OSS like that. It's people who didn't fit other places, or people who were so good at something that they were not content to serve in, you know, a regular military role or something. So Donovan was a genius, I mean, for pulling all these characters together, and then those characters went out and found more. So it built on itself.
Well, in doing it so fast, it's not like this was something pulled together in peacetime. This is something pulled together the height of war, behind the power curve, because the SOE and other organizations had been created at that point for years, and then with absolutely no backup from the JCS, from the government. Basically, FDR gave him the cover that he needed, but G2 hated Donovan, ONI hated Donovan.
They all hated Donovan.
They all hated Donovan. And he was able to pull these motley crew together to do these kind of missions that no one else wanted to do.
Well, he had one very important thing. Unvouchered funds. Lots and lots of money that he could spend however he wanted. And he did.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Let's talk a little bit about the mission of the Black Propaganda. We've hinted at this already. But really, it's not to get the Japanese soldier to do anything, right? You're not trying to convince this. I mean, to a degree, but it's really kind of plant seeds. It's kind of getting the soldier very slowly and maybe just kind of getting a nascent embryonic thoughts in his head about doubt or despair or even in some cases resentment towards his government.
Oh, absolutely. Resentment towards the officers. You know, just plant a little idea that they're getting comfort kits from home when the soldiers are no longer getting them because they were told, well, there's submarines out there stopping the supply line. And yet, you can just kind of suggest maybe the officers are still getting theirs. You know, and Betty's target in Burma were a bunch of Japanese soldiers that were on retreat from being defeated in India. And they were in bad shape. And they were ripe for all this kind of stuff. Rumors, suggestions,
I mean, they probably, if anyone who's been a soldier, might already be thinking this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of just push it along and shove it along. But you kind of also have to know the people that you're dealing with in order to find what might work the best.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems to be the most successful thing about the morale operations branch of OSS, is they were able to understand their targets better than I think the rest of the military did. I mean, or even the British, where there are people who are still thinking the Japanese were these kind of...
Oh, the British, yeah. She found a couple of good Brits that would really help her, but they were as much a problem as the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Betty ignored the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Brits, she bribed them and, would sweet talk and all that sort of thing. So.
Well, another potential target is not the soldier, but also people back at the home front.
Oh, exactly.
I talk about playing the long game, right?
Mm-hmm.
You start planting these seeds of doubt back at the families in the rear, and of course that information gets to the soldier. Now, it takes longer, but maybe it's even more powerful if it's coming from a mother or a wife or a family member.
You know, one of the last things I did when I rewrote the dissertation for the book, I got a hold of some Japanese diary collections and read those diaries from home, on the home islands. And it was amazing how spot on the morale operations people were in the, what they were targeting, how they were targeting them.
Do you think that if the CBI theater, the China-Burma-India theater, was basically the Wild West of the war, there's not a lot of oversight going on there. Do you think that they wouldn't have been able to pull off what they did if they were in a more regimented system, if they were in Europe, or if they were in, under the command of MacArthur, and not kind of in the middle of nowhere, where you had to literally fly over Mount Everest to get to some of the areas they're operating within?
Well, sure. But again, I'm going to go back to OSS, you know, just by virtue of the people in it, they were able to accomplish a lot because they just thought of things. You know, we call it thinking outside the box now, but they were doing it. Mm-hmm. Now, there were good operations in Europe with morale operations, some really successful inducements to surrender, and some great stories there. The thing is, they were happening at a time when Betty couldn't take advantage of knowing that. So, you know, it's not like she had blueprints,
right?
She and her friends.
Well, a lot of this exactly was making it up as they went along, and really getting beyond hardships that, yes, there's snakes and there's like terrible weather and it's monsoon season, but
it was all about the adventure.
Well, the adventure was made even more adventurous by the fact that they had to kind of cobble together the equipment to actually do some of these operations. Endless money only goes so far. If you can't get printing presses, you can't get the paper you need, you can't get the ink that you need in order to do this, they basically had to beg, borrow, and steal. And you've already kind of talked a little about the British, the cousins. But there were a lot of tensions between the British and the Americans. Everyone looked at the Second World War as this, like, yay, let's all do this together, everybody happy, everybody hugging. But there were, especially in the Pacific, when all the kind of the colonial tensions were involved in there, the British and Americans didn't really get along all that well.
Oh, that's kind of an understatement. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the first things that just hit me upside the head when I started this research is there was out-and-out hatred there. And, you know, the British didn't trust the Americans. They felt, you know, the Americans wanted to take their empire away from them, which wasn't all that, you know, far off base.
Right.
Especially in OSS, they were very anti-colonial. So, you know.
Well, I mean, you look at, you know, it's not just the British, too, the Dutch, the French. There are a lot of,
exactly.
I mean, you talk about how Betty runs into the man we later know in Ho Chi Minh, who, you know, was pushing against the French, and then the Dutch in Indonesia and other places did not like the OSS being there because it was clear the only way the OSS is successful is if it works with people who would later become the guerrillas and the revolutionaries against their
China's
empire.
A perfect example. I mean, you know, people have different opinions on this. My opinion is Chiang cared a lot more about, you know, fighting the communists than he did the Japanese.
Right.
And I'm not alone in that opinion. And so the OSS, you know, they went for the people who were fighting the Japanese. That was the communists.
Right. Well, we'll get to the fact that some of them were slightly communist themselves,
too.
Absolutely. This is problematic. We'll talk about that in a second. Let's look at Operation Blackmail, the kind of the title of the book. And you've already alluded to it and mentioned it, but let's break it down because we kind of went a little bit beyond what it actually was.
Mm-hmm.
So can you lay out what the plan was? Because I think it's absolutely ingenious pulling this thing together because it really hits at the heart and goes straight with a dagger right between the rib cage to try to go after, you know, that the soft squishy parts in the rear, not the soldier, but the home.
Well, it was born out of necessity because Betty landed in Delhi with none of her equipment. If you're going to do black propaganda, you have to have all kind of stuff, as you've mentioned, presses and paper. And she landed with a box of typewriter ribbon and no typewriter. That's it. So, you know, her first trip to the British kind of to beg, they let her dip her hand in a nasty captured mailbag, and that's when she pulled out these postcards. And immediately, I mean, she could read them because, like I said, it was simple language. And her first reaction was, oh, you know, these nice notes to sweethearts and wives and mothers will never reach their destination. And her friend, Bill Magistretti, pointed out, oh, look, the censor's chop is there. It's already been cleared. And so, you know, light bulbs went off, and they realized this can be slipped back in the mail stream and make it to Japan. So, you know, they just set up an operation right there, and everybody started racing and altering messages.
Yeah, don't write your postcards in pencil, because it makes it very easy just to erase and,
that's right.
and replace. Some of these were pretty extraordinary, and some of the ones that they eventually do coming back from the home front to the front, about one that you include, like, the full text of one of the letters of, very simple, it was just kind of, you know, from the wife or whatever, saying, everything's going great, you know, have you seen so-and-so? It was his wife, she's having a baby, and mm-hmm. just, it was one of these planting the seed of doubt. It reminded me a lot, you talk about some successful operations in the European theater, and there was a League of Lonely War Women operation mm-hmm. where kind of this planting this idea that the women back at home are not being loyal to the soldiers in the field. And you can imagine a 23-year-old guy who's a wife back home. It's probably not far from his mind every day about, mm-hmm. you know, is my wife being loyal? And just that kind of prick in the back of the mind to get that idea going can be absolutely destructive in the battlefield.
Yeah, and I mean, Operation Blackmail, it really was ingenious in its simplicity. It just was postcards, you know? And the messages were so in the vein of whatever had been written, so the person receiving it would feel that, well, of course this is Keiko, you know?
Right. Well, so, and it wasn't so over the top that it was obvious, right? It was just slight, just nuance, just to get the doubts going. Then they decided to kind of take it up a notch a little bit with looking at creating fictitious people, mm-hmm. looking at omens and planets aligning, and magically coming up with a bad omen. Something horrible is going to happen in August of 45, which that certainly worked out well for them. And even things like creating rumors that the Soviets are entering the war, which is the nightmare for the Japanese of fighting this two-front war.
Well, again, this is what happens when you enlist people like anthropologists and historians and even bird watchers, because bird watchers know everything about the culture they've had to live in, you know, to watch their birds in New Guinea. And so you get people who know that, you know, the Japanese did live in fear of Russians pouring over the border. So it took informed, educated people to be able to know how to target some of these things.
Well, you'd mentioned the use of POWs a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. that Betty knew when she needed to go beyond her level of knowledge. And it's a really strange dynamic here. And you lay it out in the book, and that's something that I didn't really know all that well, that you didn't get a lot of Japanese surrendering. That is, you know, an idea that a lot of us have that is relatively true, that it was rare to have. You didn't have whole units of Japanese surrendering like you did for the Germans. But when they did, they essentially were the model prisoners.
I know. Doesn't that blow you away?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you think about it, I'm like, okay, that kind of makes sense.
But is over as they knew it. And they've been conditioned, and it's true. They were conditioned to follow orders and do what you were told to the best of your ability. Be the best, you know, whatever your whoever is in authority is telling you to be. See, Betty knew that there were cases of these prisoners because she had attended back in Washington. Ruth Benedict and Margaret Mead came in and talked at length to them about these situations where you had Japanese pilots that, you know, they surrendered, and then they would get up in the plane and they would ride and guide, you know,
they basically
the Americans
navigators
to targets.
To like, yeah.
So
this is extraordinary, and that allowed her to put stuff in front of the POWs, especially ones mm-hmm. that were higher ranked, mm-hmm. and deal with that whole problem of her not understanding how to do more formal Japanese.
Yeah.
And that really came in handy with the surrender orders. Now, what I thought was hilarious was that it even fooled the Office of War Information.
I just love that.
That's when you know how good your black propaganda is when your own government takes it as real.
You know, the OWI was a little bit like the British with OSS. They had a little bit of a love-hate relationship. So, yeah, they always kind of loved it when they could sort of twist the knife to OWI, fool them along with everyone else.
Well, you'd already mentioned that they were able to know that this actually worked a little bit, because a lot of the Japanese that surrendered had the leaflets in their hand that automatically thought back to Desert Storm, where the same basic kind of concept of creating these leaflets and the Iraqis were surrendering. Did this change the perception of black propaganda among the leadership, among the people who had kind of poo-pooed it before, like you talk about MacArthur and others? Because beginning the Japanese to surrender was a pretty big deal.
No, it didn't. You know, their hatred for Donovan, their hatred for unconventional means of doing things, the military command structure, you know, if anything, it annoyed them. And it's not like these inducements to surrender were successful on a vast scale. Just enough, really. There was one case, Ramri Island, down on the coast of Burma, where pretty much 300 Japanese surrendered because of the black propaganda campaign. That was unusual.
Right.
So, you know, the military command structure looked at all that and pretty much, you know, didn't like Donovan, didn't like OSS, let's get back to business kind of thing.
What was it, Nimitz or Halsey or one of them, that just, the whole point was just to kill Japanese? Like, forget this nonsense.
Kill Japs, and kill more Japs. Yes.
Yeah, so well, and then there are the stories about Japanese actually trying to surrender and not being successful at it. And we don't need to get too much into kind of the sociology of war and the reasons that happened, and you know, that can take us off in a direction we don't need to go in.
Well, if anybody in your audience wants to get into that, John Dewar wrote the books, War Without Mercy, and, you know, documents the cases of Japanese pretending to surrender and then blowing themselves up. And you do that a few times in a row out there in the Pacific, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that probably every military has had to deal with for thousands of years, is the fake surrenders, and you just get to the point where you're like, nope,
we're done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of my favorite stories in this book was a short one, but it's when the team decided it needed to black propaganda their own people. And this was the case of the Christian missionaries.
Oh, the missionaries?
Which, they got so good at it, they're like, you know what? Let's just do it to these guys and get them working with us. Can you tell that story? It's just so good.
Well, the missionaries were a wonderful contingent of morale operations and OSS because, again, they knew, you know, they knew the dialects and they, you know, they had lived in these countries on the ground. But, yeah, they had their scruples. And so Betty, I mean, that was... It was pure genius to convince them that, you know, these Japanese were encouraging the slaughter of Christians and whatnot. They got on board real fast and were very effective.
Do you know if they ever found out they had been duped and that the documents that said that they were murdering Christians were made by Betty?
I think by the time they might have found that out, they didn't care.
Well, we had talked about the fact that there were very few jobs for women during World War II that were of any kind of semblance of, you know, leadership positions or certainly anything that would give someone like Betty job satisfaction outside of what she was doing. But amazingly, when a job position opened to be the actual head of the morale operations in the CBI theater, she got chosen for it. I mean, is there any other instances in OSS history where a woman was put in charge, essentially of a theater operation like that?
Well, yes. In China, Burma, India, I'm trying to think of her name. She taught at Harvard for years. She was in charge of secret intelligence. She was an anthropologist. Again, OSS, Donovan, you know, he kind of had a little bit of a reputation as a ladies' man. I don't know about that, but I will say that when it came to operations, he was gender blind. And if you could do the job, he didn't care if you were a convict or a communist or a woman. You got the job. And that's pretty much, I mean, there were a lot of exceptions, but as a whole, that's how the organization worked.
Is there evidence that that served to change people's minds outside of OSS about the ability of women during World War II? Seeing people like Betty do this job and do it really, really well, did that bleed out into outside of the OSS to the kind of soldiers in the field?
I don't know. I mean, you know, you've got the whole Rosie the Riveter thing, and there's a it's outside my field.
I was just wondering if you knew. I mean, I suspect probably not. I mean,
the early CIA, Betty, because of her expertise in Asia, got sent there by Dulles. A lot of other women, like Virginia Hall, the one with the wooden leg that was a true hero for training the Maquis, got put behind a desk.
Yeah.
You know, so things reverted.
Let's talk about some of the people who Betty worked with who did not have a great end of the war. People like Jane Foster and others that were targeted in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And kind of the history of OSS during this time that was, talk about shooting yourself in the foot of some of the most talented people who had been working on these operations, not just black morale operations, but we're talking about commandos and people working in the field who were targeted as being too left-leaning by people like Joe McCarthy, but it's not all McCarthyism. It starts before that, HUAC, and before McCarthy even comes on the scene. But Foster, who was, I guess you could argue, Betty's best friend, was someone that our listeners will know. This name, Elizabeth Bentley, who was dimed out specifically by Bentley, and it drove her to suicide.
Suicide attempts.
Suicide attempts.
Yeah. Well, yes, she became very isolated. You know, whereas Betty went into the CIA, Jane was indicted for multiple counts of espionage. It's going to be the subject of my next book. Betty was convinced of her innocence, especially during the war, because the FBI was arguing that Jane was, spying for the Soviets during the war. And Betty was adamant. And I've gone through the NKVD transcripts. They talk about her, but it's all in terms of, can we recruit this person? Should we? You know, the same sort of chatter that you get with any prospect that they are looking at. I couldn't find any hard, this is what we're getting sort of thing. I mean, Jane was a 1930s communist. There were millions of them in this country. And left-leaning, yes.
Well, and someone so talented that it would be stupid if the NKVD wasn't talking about trying to recruit her. Mm-hmm. And, that sometimes, unfortunately, was used as proof, and not just for her, for a lot of others.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, you appeared in Venona. You must have been... No.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're a good organization. They're going to try to recruit people that are good. Mm-hmm. And, that's problematic. And for many in OSS, I mean, you can imagine the early years of CIA could have been extraordinarily better if they hadn't forced out or essentially prevented so many people that had been, perfected by war in the OSS from joining CIA, or people who had joined CIA and then got pushed out because of McCarthyism.
Well, and I'm going to lay a lot of it at J. Edgar's feet. Mm-hmm. His hatred for Donovan was so intense, and Betty told me that, and I talked to some people today. I was at a wonderful presentation of retired intelligence officers, and they talked about how they were dogged by the FBI after the war. Their homes were searched, and it was ridiculous, So it wasn't just MacArthur.
Right. Well, Betty herself was going to not continue her espionage work, was going to not continue being an intelligence officer after the war. She had moved on to other things. Mm-hmm. She married her second husband and had a very loving relationship until the mid-1950s. And then kind of had a second career in intelligence. I mean, at 43, she basically decided to go back into doing intelligence work and did it until what? She was in her 80s, I guess, when she...
Well, she didn't really decide to go back. Her husband had died. And her friends, who had been in OSS, started, she was depressed. She was sad. And they just started talking to her and saying, you know, you need to go see Alan Dulles. And apparently one night they were partying out on a boat in the Potomac and convinced her. And so she went to see him. He said, are you ready to get back to work? And he went on from there.
And do we know a lot about, I know there's a lot of stuff that's probably still classified. Do we know a lot about what she did at CIA? I know she went back to Japan, but she was in the CIA from the 50s all the way through the 80s. Do we have any idea of her career at the agency?
I've tried to piece it together, and there's some open source things out there that hint at stuff. But, you know, it was basically influence operations. I mean, same sort of thing, I guess.
So she was probably not in the DO, probably doing, you know, she was an operator? She
well,
was a case officer?
In Japan she was, sure, yes. So
kind of bringing back some of the old stuff from before. You lead off the book, if I remember right, with post 9/11, and just kind of gives you a little bit of the idea about the personality of Betty Pack. McIntosh. That get my Bettys confused, who are doing intelligence work in World War II, where at the age of 80 something, after 9/11, she said, "Put me to work."
Yeah, called him right up.
And some of the articles I've read about her, till the day she died, which was not that long ago, she was still doing what she could to give back to the agency, giving talks and talking to younger officers, talking to younger
people. My dear friend Tony Hiley, who's director of the CIA Museum, described her in front of a bunch of, you know, influence operation officers. And Tony said, you know, she would just lean in and go totally operational and had their total attention, because she just slipped right back into it.
Well, it's amazing that you can own that kind of an audience, because, you know, this little old lady who is sitting in front of all these, you know, CIA people who at the beginning of their career or midway through think they know what they're doing, and then when she starts talking, everyone just shuts up and listens. This is somebody that had decades.
I mean, I was privileged to go to Langley with her two or three times. People, I mean, she's a rock star there. People would line up to shake her hand, and, you know, which was gratifying to see.
Yeah, it's rare that in this world that you have somebody that is kind of universally respected, because the top people will find a way to create enemies. You know, whether they're former directors who have political enemies, or there are people in operations that they had the left hate them or the right hate them or somebody in between. It's rare that somebody that spent that much time doing this kind of intelligence work, kind of the darker side, it's not called black propaganda for no reason, are just universally respected across the board like she was.
I've never talked to anyone who knew her that didn't just think the world of her. She was a very gracious person. And the fact that she had this wicked capability makes it all the better.
Well, if you want to know more about her, there's only one place to go. The book is OSS Operation Blackmail, One Woman's Covert War Against the Imperial Japanese Army. The author is Ann Todd. Ann, thank you so much for talking to us at SpyCast. This book was, again, a breath of fresh air. In this job, I get lots of books sent to me, and every OSS book reads somewhat similarly, and this was one that just kind of came. It's another OSS book, and then I started reading. I'm like, oh, this one's different in all the right ways. So I appreciate you writing this. I appreciate you taking what had to have been an extraordinary amount of work to put into this. It's a fascinating book. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, you're welcome, Vince, and the pleasure was all mine.